We're just over 1 week away from ringing in the new year, but before we unwrap our presents or don our New Year's party hats and noisemakers, let's take a moment to look back on the year that was. And if you're a news junkie like me, that means pondering the major news stories of 2012. So this hour, I'm bringing in two fellow news hounds from Western Wisconsin to discuss what the top stories were and perhaps what their favorite news stories were and have been over the past 354 days. This is the Westside 2012 News Year in Review on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rich Kramer, and joining me in the studio are two veteran news reporters. First, I'd like to welcome Don Hoopscher, editor of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. Thanks so much for joining us, Don.
Glad to be here.
Good to have you. And also, I'd like to welcome Jerry Gallagher, and Jerry is the assistant news director for WQOW News 18. Thanks so much, Jerry.
Thank you, Rich.
And this show wouldn't be what it is without input from our listeners. So what do you think the top news story was of 2012? What was your favorite story? Why? What was your least favorite? Or did we in the news media miss something that you would like to know more about? Give us a call. The number is 800-228-5615. That number again, 800-228-5615. Or you can post your message or question or whatever on Facebook, on the Westside Facebook page. So with that, let's get started. And before we even get into the state or the local stories, gentlemen, I think it goes without saying that the tragedy that happened last Friday at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newton, Connecticut, was easily the biggest, or at least the most memorable story of 2012. And since we've all gotten our share of the horrible run of events, I thought it would be good to talk about the media coverage with fellow media moguls like yourselves. Don Hoopscher, how do you think the coverage was handled on this terrible event?
Well, you know, as usual in something like this, the authorities were being kind of close-lipped early, which led to some inaccurate reports that they had the wrong brother being the killer. Then there were reports that the mother was a teacher at the school. Mm-hmm. There was another report I heard that the father was the one who was killed in the house. And so, you know, as the media descended on this community, they were looking for any morsels they could. And, of course, you know, the competitive juices get going, and they want to get this information out to the public as quickly as they can. So it took a little while for things to settle down. One report I saw very early on, I think it bothered a lot of people. I saw some comments on it. It was a reporter shoving a microphone in the face of one of the girls, or, you know, what did you see? And I that's not something I would do. Mm-hmm. But I guess as it went on, those were some of the only witnesses. And so, you know, maybe you could have done something off camera. I thought that was a little bit over the top, especially right after the incident.
It might be too simplistic to start placing blame or to place blame at all. But I mean, is this a case of reporters being overzealous, or, as you mentioned, I mean, was it kind of a shared thing with the police coming out with the information that was incorrect, and then the reporters just jumping on it?
I would say that I think that it's part of what Don said already, in that when there is a lack of information flowing from your lead officials, the investigators in this case, the reporters will go elsewhere looking for that information. And what you tend to see in a situation like this, look at where these mass shootings for the most part have happened over the years. Smaller towns, rural areas. And unfortunately, these law enforcement agencies are not as well equipped or trained to handle a media crush like you see. I mean, you had folks from CNN, mm-hmm. the networks, major newspapers. They were there in Newtown within, I would say, 2 hours. That's not a lot of time when this situation was still unfolding and developing. And so I can certainly sympathize with what those folks have to do in a situation like that. Don and I have both seen it before, not on that grand of a scale, most likely. But they need time to be able to collaborate and to make sure that there weren't two shooters in that facility. That was one of those things that came out that was misreported. And sometimes the media just has to take a step back, slow down, and that just is so much easier said than done with all of the different avenues that we have now to report from and what the viewers want, what the readers want, and they want it so quickly.
Speaking of the media crush, I remember watching one of the press conferences. There must have been, it looked like 50 microphones piled up on top of each other on that podium. So what about, you know, I'm sure you both have seen on Facebook a lot of long posts, you know, paragraph upon paragraph about how the media is giving too much coverage and sensationalizing this thing. Don Hoopster, how do we balance that? How do the reporters in Newtown, Connecticut, balance the need to get the information out there, also the need to get it out first, if possible, versus sensationalism?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by sensationalism. If you mean putting a microphone into the face of a six-year-old kid,
well, that
I think that's over the top. But you have
or nonstop
a major, well, yeah, but we have round-the-clock networks, not news networks. That's what they do. Mm. And I was watching it a little bit on Saturday morning after, and I shut it off. I just couldn't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think you always have that freedom, you know. And a lot of times people say, well, I didn't like a certain article in the paper, or I didn't like your editorial. You don't like to be flip about it, but one of the things I say, well, if it bothered you that much, turn the page. And I think as consumers of news, we have to make those decisions. But this was a horrific, by any measure, story that is going to be widely reported. And I know there are some people that just couldn't get enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things about all the choices we have in the media. Now, you get to make that choice.
I saw one comment from somebody saying, stop talking about the shooter.
Right.
You know, stop talking about Lanza. And one of the cable networks in particular made a point, and at the beginning of their show, they would say, we're going to spend this entire hour talking about the victims. We're not going to give any credence to the shooter because that's what he would have wanted. I don't necessarily agree with that, because I think that part of the story is we need to find out who this guy was and what was his background, what were his troubles, what led him to this. And it's very possible we may never know all of those answers, even some of those answers, but I think it's important to address that. And I heard somebody else, a psychologist interviewed on one of the other shows the other night, who said, don't be quick to judge that is what he wanted, to go out in a blaze of glory, to be remembered for eternity. This psychologist said, I've interviewed many mass shooters over the years who survived and are locked up, and many of them, that's not at all what they were trying to accomplish. I mean, they're sick individuals.
Right. So the news, I caught, I think it was Anderson Cooper, which I believe was at CNN. They were saying that we're not going to mention that. But that's part of our responsibility, is it not, to
it's a huge part of the story.
Yeah.
As are the victims. And I don't think that you can give enough coverage to that, but you've got to be able, in my opinion, you have to be able to talk about who this person is and what he did.
Now, one thing that one comment I saw on Facebook, and again, you know, the 10 years ago, this wouldn't even be a conversation because you don't have, you know, the anonymous postings and whatnot. But I saw one post that was blaming the media for what happened, at least in part. It said the media is half to blame because, you know, because the media does make heroes out of, you know, out of these characters. And because of that, as you mentioned, you know, some people would think that they're looking for that kind of attention. What do you make of that, Don Hoopster?
Well, I think if someone thinks that he has been portrayed as a hero in the media, they'd believe anything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we need to go out of our way to mention his name all that much. You mentioned that he was his age and whatever, but I don't know. There was a crime. This is a fact in the crime, and that's what we do, is we report facts. So I guess we could debate this thing to death, but to suggest that the media caused this guy to do what he did, I reject that.
Yeah, I would say same here. I would say that we have a responsibility, and to some degree we have not done a good job in recent years in that we have the media, along with a lot of other factors, have helped cultivate this sense of confrontation in our society, it seems like today, that, you know, you watch the cable talk shows when they cover politics and it's a shouting match. Mm-hmm. And that's all it seems to be. And in fact, just the other day, as I was learning of this news, it was Friday at noon, I came upon, I was driving on Hastings Way, came up to an intersection, and the woman right in front of me in her vehicle stopped in front of me, got out of her car, went and started pounding on the driver's side window of the car in front of her. I have no idea what the problem was, but it's just something that that has become more part and parcel of our society today, that it seems like every molehill is blown up into a mountain. You know,
is that,
and I think the media, you know, part of what we do is to, we should help cultivate responsible conversation, and we don't always do that.
Right. Is that lazy reporting then? Because that's easy to find any little bit of conflict and then build on that.
Well, I'll give you an example. Yesterday, as I know the Leader Telegram has done this as well, we've had conversations about the debate about gun control since Friday, and we interviewed somebody who had some comments on one side of the issue that we thought would only serve to inflame and just kind of spewed rhetoric. And so we had a conversation in the newsroom. Well, should we? I mean, this is what the person said, and they are somewhat of an authority figure, but how does this further the conversation? And we decided to keep it out of the story. We don't always do that. But yesterday, we just had a lengthy conversation about that one particular thing, and I think that we bear the responsibility to do that more often.
All right. Well, my heart, and I'm sure your hearts, go out to the victims' families and that whole community, which is, you know, has this new reality to live in with what happened and what's now part of their history. So, our thoughts and prayers. That's all I can say. With that, let's move to some kind of similar stories. What happened in Wisconsin this past year, and we had two high-profile shootings, one at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek and another in at the salon in Brookfield. And even in Eau Claire, we had a situation where there was a stabbing, possibly gang-related, not far from our studios, and a situation where a couple of situations, high-speed pursuits, and a young man was shot near Hastings Way. Don Hoopshire, are we getting more violent as a society, or what are your thoughts on all these things?
Well, I read something the other day that murder rates have actually gone down.
Right.
I think sometimes, not so much the situations you just mentioned, but sometimes crime is a byproduct of the economy. If people are desperate, sometimes they do things. They make bad decisions. And I'm not blaming the economy on what happened locally. I don't think that was a connection. But sometimes you see that happen, that people are desperate. But every situation is different. Every troubled individual is different. And then, you know, we haven't had a murder here in a while. And then we had a couple. Mm-hmm. Then we had the horrific incident over in River Falls. I mean, those things kind of ebb and flow. I don't think you can make a broader determination about that. I just think it was one of those years where we had a couple murders.
Right. Yeah. Jerry Gallagher, any thoughts?
I would agree. I think that Don hit the nail on the head, and that it's very difficult to look at these individual cases and make kind of an overarching statement. I will say that I think that we are going to have a national conversation here in the coming months about mental health and the need for more funding, signs and symptoms, how important it is for folks at home to get their loved ones help, maybe somebody in a school system, somebody at an office to be able to see, look, this person, I believe, is depressed or they might have some mental health issues. We need to get them to you know, the right people, the right experts to be able to be seen. I think that's something that we're going to be talking about more.
Yeah, and with luck, you know, some good can come of that overall for society. Looks like we've got one call coming in right now. We're going to take our first break here on the Westside 2012 News Year in Review. I'm joined by Jerry Gallagher of News 18 here in Eau Claire and Don Hoopscher, editor of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. We'll be right back. We'll take your calls. And listeners, if you want to get in on this conversation, let us know what you think the top news story is, what your favorite story was. Give us a call, 800-228-5615. We'll be right back with more West Side after this. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to the West Side 2012
Support for W
News here in Review on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in. I'm joined in studio by two local reporters. Don Hoopscher is the editor of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, and Jerry Gallagher is the assistant news director for WQOW News 18. We're talking about the top stories as we see it, and also we want to know what top stories were as you see it. So, listeners, give us a call at 800-228-5615 and let us know what your favorite or what you think the top most attention-grabbing news story of 2012 was. 800-228-5615. And with that, we're going to take our first call of the evening, and we're going to go to Willem in Colfax. Willem, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in. What do you think the top news story for 2012 was, either locally, regionally, or statewide, nationally?
I think locally, this frac sand mining that's going on, even though it might not be the biggest news story, you know, as an immediate event, but I think the effect that it's going to have and is having on our region, I think, is really kind of changes the nature of the area where we live. I have a friend who lives close to the sand mines, and she has four little boys that can't play outside anymore because of truck traffic, and she's concerned about the silica dust. And one of the things that I think has not been spoken about much or reported much about is the plans to not only use this sand for domestic production, but to export this sand to other countries where they're doing fracking. Like I have another friend whose daughter just got hired as a consultant and a scientist to work in, to go to New Guinea where they're you know, looking into fracking and other areas. So, and another woman that in NAP, that was when she said she was concerned about how long it would, this, you know, is this going to last 5-10 years? They assured her that it was going to go on for a lot longer than that because they were going to export the sand. And I think that's a part of the story that hasn't really been covered, this exporting of the sand, which means there's no end to it, because even if fracking is stopped in this country, they'll need the sand somewhere else. And, you know, these are permanent, irreversible changes to the topography of western Wisconsin. And, you know, once, I mean, it's one thing to clear-cut land and have the trees grow back, but actually to remove the land, these hills that function as a, you know, a place for wildlife to live and for water to be filtered. And so I think it's a really important story.
All right, we got you, Willem, and I'll put this one first to Don Hoopscher. Don, in 2011, we saw what was reported as a doubling in the amount of facilities, either mining or processing facilities for frac sand. This year, it seems to maybe have slowed down a little bit, but still a huge story. What are you seeing on the editorial page regarding frac sand?
Well, continued concerns, just like the callers, about the environmental impact, short-term and long-term, of frac mining. The problem I have is, you know, I'm not an expert on this and most other things. So what you do is you try to find the people who are, and in this situation, the best folks we have right now are the Department of Natural Resources.
Tom Woolitz.
They have not stepped in to put a stop to this. And so when people say, you know, my kid's going to die of cancer and all that, and you should be reporting that, well, I don't know that that's the case. And I'm not sure anybody knows for sure, because this is kind of a new deal.
Mm-hmm.
I wish the state would have gotten more involved as kind of an overseer. The town board members can't be expected to be experts on this.
When they're up against, you know, multi-million-dollar corporations or even
Well,
bigger.
Right. I mean, they come in and they would defer to the state, okay, and the state would say, well, based on our air pollution rules and what we know, this isn't something that we think is unsafe. And so they go ahead and but then, you know, okay, can we do this? Can we dig this? Can we go here? Can we go there? And like I said, town board members, I would imagine, are overwhelmed. So that's, you know, that's the one thing. I hadn't heard about the exporting of the sand overseas. I think that is probably a story that needs to be pursued. But it certainly is a huge story. I mean, this thing just came on so fast, certainly faster than our ability to become experts on it.
Right. Well, we did last week had a program about frac sand mining and its contribution to the resurgence of some rail lines in western Wisconsin. We had Jeff Plaley, State Commissioner of Railroads, and he mentioned that some – he said now we're exporting sand to Saudi Arabia, which was the first I had heard of it. So it's something that maybe we should look into a little bit more. Jerry Gallagher, you've got Sandstorm of Business series that has been airing on WQOW. You've been doing a lot of reporting on it. The state, you know, a lot of people want the state to take a more active role, but legislators aren't too excited to – at least the ones that have been on my program are not too eager to have this be taken from the local control to the state.
And some have said if we were seeing the level of sand mining that we currently are in western Wisconsin in another part of the state.
Yeah, as southeast Wisconsin.
Correct, that you would have seen more state lawmaker involvement. The fact is we just don't at this point. And so, as Don said, you know, you rely on those that, you know, are the figureheads, are the authority figures, and that would be the DNR. But we are also in the midst of a number of studies that are being done. And so, whereas I feel like, from what I have been told, that we are nearing that ceiling of domestic production and capacity and knowing that we have the mines and processing plants in Wisconsin, in the Midwest, that will be enough to produce what is needed domestically, the international thing opens up a whole other can of worms.
Sure.
And so this story will continue. I think it will die down somewhat from where we've been in the last year, but it will continue.
And you recently took this leads into another story that we had locally where Menards is now hiring people in Eau Claire and going to fly them back and forth to work at the Menards in Minot, North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
But you took a trip to the oil fields in North Dakota. Well, tell us a little bit about that. I mean, that was fascinating to me. I'd love to get over there myself. But is it like the Wild West boomtown gold rush over there?
I wouldn't quite go as far as to compare it to the Wild West. But it is unlike anything that I have seen or experienced.
How so?
I'll give you an example. First night that we get there, we're staying in the Teddy Roosevelt National Park. We pull up, check in at our hotel. My photographer and I want to go grab a bite to eat. So, I mean, we're in town just for 10 minutes, go to a restaurant, pull up to the restaurant. First thing I see when I get out of my vehicle to walk up to the restaurant is a man standing over his wife, screaming at her, pointing his finger into her face, saying, "This is it. I will be filing divorce papers. I'll be serving you with divorce papers tomorrow." I mean, again, it was this whole confrontation. This is the very first image that I get. And so I'm thinking, okay, is this the norm out here?
Yeah.
That this is kind of what I'm going to be seeing? I did see some altercations beyond that over the course of the several days that I was there. That was the extreme. But there is an edginess about
really?
Life out there. There is. The man-to-woman ratio is probably about 10 to 1 right now. You have a lot of men coming from all parts of the country, different backgrounds, basically into one melting pot, all looking for the same thing, mm-hmm. to make a lot of money and make it quickly. So you throw all of that together, and it's going to be a diverse population with a lot of testosterone. And it's very interesting to witness. I would say the time that I was out there, the period of which that I had the most concern for my safety, because a lot of people say, well, you're going to see lots of fights and you know, do you think you should be armed when you're out there? I didn't feel that way at all. the time that I felt most concerned about my safety was actually driving on a highway late at night on a Saturday night, because the amount of drilling that's going on out there, the infrastructure is not keeping up with it.
Oh.
The roads still are narrow, and there's so much semi-traffic coming at you. And I was driving at night. I had about a two-hour trip back to my hotel Saturday night about 9 o'clock, and I had headlight after headlight after headlight, about 65 miles an hour, coming right at me. Mm. And these are big rigs. And I just had a car, and it was a very narrow highway. And so that was a white knuckler for about 2 hours. Mm. And so that's a major thing out there, is that the infrastructure is not keeping up with what's happening.
Reminder to the listeners, we want you to be part of this program. If you have a top news story that you'd like to bring up for discussion from 2012, give us a call at 800-228-5615. That number again is 1-800-228-5615. You can also post on our website and Facebook page. And as I mentioned, the boom is happening so rapidly in the oil fields of North Dakota. I think I spoke with a state geologist there. This was for a story that they were looking into making their own ceramic type of frac sand, mm-hmm. or ceramic type bead that would maybe compete with frac sand. But they said just in the last year, there was 2,300 new wellheads or something installed. That's amazing to me. Don Hoopscher, the Menards is willing to make as much of an investment as hiring people locally and flying them over to North Dakota. Is that something that you've ever seen before? Was that a surprising move to you?
Well, no, I've never seen anything like that before. Yeah. I don't know about surprising. I guess when you think about it, if the demand is there for their product and they need people to help, you know, man the store, and they've got the corporate jets here, and they have people willing to do it, I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, I guess it does too. But the amount of money over there, Jerry, I think it was on your station that there was an account of a young man who, I remember him saying, people ask me, you know, what the difference is in the wages I make, and he said, if you took the salary that I used to make mm-hmm. when I was here, I now pay more than that in taxes. Mm-hmm. And he was a laborer, if I mm-hmm. remember correctly. Mm-hmm.
Yep, he was an excavator. He helps clear the land. And he makes in upwards of six figures a year. Young guy, about 25 years old. Mm-hmm. And I was interviewing him on a rig site. And a guy who was working on the rig, there were only about six or eight guys working on the rig, jumped down and came storming at us. And so I thought, uh-oh, here we go. And I'm on public land, and the rig was behind us on mm-hmm. private land, but we were standing on public land, so I was well within my right to be interviewing this young guy from Eau Claire. Guy comes up to me and says, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm interviewing this young man, and he said, well, I just want to know because I live in Phoenix Park.
Oh, yeah?
So this guy who was working on the rig was also from Eau Claire. It had no idea, had never met this other young man from Eau Claire. So that just gives you an idea. We were, you know, 6 hours from home, and there's a whole lot of local flavor out there.
I bet.
A lot of people chasing their dreams.
We'll go back to the phones now, and we've got a call coming in from Bloomer. Rhonda is on the line. Rhonda, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a question regarding financing for these companies that are coming in. I have worked for three of the companies that have come into the area. Actually, one of the very first companies that came in was called CSP, which is Canadian Sand and Proppants, yep. which has been bought out now by EOG.
Right.
I was employee number two there. And then I worked for a company called Wind Bay Sand, which was in Blair, Wisconsin, which now has been bought out by a company called Preferred Sand, which I worked for in Bloomer. And what I'm finding, the first two companies were started or funded by Canadian gentlemen. And there's there still is a shortage for frac sand in Canada. So they were looking for a resource. But the way that those companies were funded and ran, as far as I'm concerned, was almost criminal. Hmm. And then with the company that was in Bloomer, they basically came in, hired close to 30 people, and were gone within a year. Now, they bought the company in Blair, but I've talked to a lot of people, and the question is always, these frack mining companies are funded by the Halliburtons and the, I won't say EOG now because they have their own plant, but that's where they get their funding from. They do pre-buys for sand, and they use that money then to build their wash plant and dry plant. But to my knowledge, there is no course of, okay, do they have their funding for these projects they're starting? They're hiring all these people. Where's the, you know, where is the money coming from? Is it accountable? Is it are you going to be here in a year? Are you kind of a fly-by-night organization?
Sure. We hear you there, Rhonda. Anyone want to take a stab at that? Again, as Don Hoopscher mentioned, we are not the experts here. We just talked to the people who are Jerry Gallagher or anything.
Well, my guess is they'll stick around as long as they can make money doing
right.
what they're doing. The
right.
minute they can't, they'll leave.
Right.
That's a slippery slope because if you start designating certain requirements for those businesses, then what's to say, you know, we have businesses, that companies that go out of business all the time.
Sure.
You know, once they don't make any money, then they pack up and go somewhere else or fold up shop or what have you. So it's tough to say we're going to put these parameters on frac sand.
But the as far as where the money's coming from, as she mentioned, the some of the companies from Canada, we had one from, it was overseas. It was a company that, I thought it was a Belgium company that had come to Western Wisconsin. And
oh, that was a Russian company.
It was. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and also EOG, Enron Oil and Gas, that's the new name for that. So it's, the money's coming from all over, and there's quite a bit of it. That's about all I can tell you, Rhonda, but maybe something to keep our eyes on. Those proprietary things are very, very hard to get a hold of.
Well, see, for me, when I look at it, I think about, because I personally saw it, all the people that are hurt by these companies that come in and have these claims of, okay, we're going to start a wash plant here, a dry plant, we're going to hire 30 people. And then within a year, you know, a lot of these people have left good jobs.
Sure.
And they're gone. No care at all for the employees. They're just, oh, sorry, guys, we're going to shut the doors today.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, and we'll keep covering the issue, no doubt, for many other reasons other than that. But thanks a lot, Rhonda. Other callers, we've got wide open phone lines. The number is 800-228-5615. Tell us what you think the top news story of 2012 was. We already talked a little bit about frac sand mining. I figured that would come up pretty early because it is a big issue for our listeners in Western Wisconsin. Let's talk a little bit about elections. This was the year of the nonstop election in Wisconsin, and for certain TV stations or for TV stations, radio stations, it was a big, there was a lot of money moving around, and I'm sure Jerry would love to tell us, you know, how much his station made on political advertisements. But anyhow, let's talk about the recall election first. Don Hoopscher, the whole collective bargaining thing, the fallout from that, the recalls last year, this year, very divisive politically, whether it be on the editorial page, whether it be on comment sections for stories, or in the state house. It seemed like labor had a lot of momentum going into the recall election, but was there any shock in your newsroom when the governor won so handily?
No.
Why not?
Well, I think that, of course, the opponents to Governor Walker were very vocal right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there was an intimidation factor there, that some people felt, hey, I don't want to stick my neck out. I've got to do business in this community or whatever. And, you know, there are a lot of people who, you know, would disagree with me, and I just don't want to go there. But I think what sealed the deal, I think, I think there were a lot of people who felt this way, that maybe Governor Walker is not going to be reelected in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe what he did was sleight of hand, but it was not a reason to remove the governor from office. I think at the end that was what determined the vote. It wasn't that everybody was in love with what he did, It's just that that was not the threshold to remove a sitting governor from office.
So instead of it being like a referendum on him or what he had done, it was more a referendum on how the process was being used or misused by some people.
I mean, I have nothing to base that on other than anecdotal, but I heard a couple people who don't even normally vote who did vote, and they said, you know what? What they're doing to him is wrong. That's not a reason to kick a person out of office.
Right, well, not malfeasance.
You know, the threshold has to be higher than that.
Mm-hmm. I heard from a union leader who said he was not going to vote on the day of the recall for the very same reasons that Don just spelled out. And I think for those who supported the recall, and again, this is anecdotally, as we were just talking about, but you kind of heard the air go out of the balloon when Russ Feingold said he would not run.
Yeah.
Well, privately, they were telling you they were banking on that, and they were really hoping that he would wade in, and he didn't.
Russ Feingold, Dave Olby, you know, and the other names. Now, as Don alluded to, Walker, you know, Governor Walker is going to face a statewide election. Well, we saw the Republicans in the state legislature do pretty well in the general election, but then statewide offices like Senate or elections like Senate and president went for the Democrats. So what does that mean?
Effective gerrymandering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, they did
beautiful
a crafty job of drawing that up.
And not that the Democrats don't do it or any other
party.
Well,
this was the first opportunity for one party in charge that had total control.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, when it's done every 10 years, at least the last three times, I believe it is, there was split leadership. And so they had no choice but to sit down and kind of work things out. This time the Republicans had total control and sat down and did a good job of making sure that they created a number of safe districts. And I mean, the city of Eau Claire, they basically wrote off to the Democrats.
They didn't even run a candidate.
But in exchange for that, Republicans won in some districts they may not have in the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, and that happened around the state.
Jerry Gallagher, does this not bode well for Governor Walker? I mean, granted, there's still some people that are going to be mad at him for what he did, but statewide election, there's no voting districts in a statewide election. Are you going to throw any predictions out there?
No, the most important factor is job creation over the next 2 years. I mean, let's see where that goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he staked his candidacy on it a couple of years ago, the 250,000. And right now we've had various reports come out this week about truly where are we in terms of how many have been created since he took office. But I think that you will see that to be the biggest key.
Gotcha. And The gerrymandering or the redistricting, however you want to label it, it was very, very effective for the Republicans in the state legislature. Although there was one office, one Republican that was a freshman who did not get reelected, and that was Roger Rivard up in our region anyway, that lost to a newcomer to state politics is Stephen Smith. I believe his mother was in the legislature. But what do you think did it? I mean, there was the famous quote from Roger Rivard that he was explaining something that his father told him, and his quote was that just made huge headlines. Some girls, they rape easy. Was that the undoing of the Rivard reelection campaign, Don Hampshire?
Well, I didn't follow it that close. I'm sure it didn't help.
Yeah.
You know. It's funny though how you know people wait to spring things. You know, it's like the
right.
Mitt Romney 47% comment. I'm sure somebody held that for just the right time, and I think the Rivard comment was actually made a year ago.
It was,
and
December of
and so
11.
Somebody dug that up at the opportune time. And
mm-hmm.
But you know that's the world we live in.
What about spending, Jerry Gallagher? Even in the you know, the some of the races that shouldn't have been very that competitive, or they weren't expected to be because the maps were favoring the Republicans, there was still a lot of money spent locally, and then ungodly amounts spent in the recall election. Are elections just going to keep getting more and more expensive? Are we going to be pricing the average guy or gal out of this?
That's a fair question. I would say we saw the amount of spending that we did, even in some what would consider to be strongholds for one party or the other is because the voter to this day in Wisconsin is still considered to be among the more independent across the country. I mean, just look at how the recall went compared to how the presidential election in the Senate
or even
election
how close,
was held in Wisconsin.
Even how close like the Supreme Court races were.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't take much to swing it one way or another. I mean, we are effectively a purple state.
That's what I hear.
You know, when it comes to a lot of these races.
That's what I hear. Back to the phones. We're going to take probably, we might be able to squeeze in one more call, but this may well be the last call of the evening. And we go back to Colfax. Elaine is on the air. Elaine, thanks so much for calling in. What do you think the top news story of 2012 was?
Well, I think the top news story was the recall petition drive, and also with the criminal activity in the governor's office when he was Milwaukee County executive. And along with that, those stories, I wondered why no journalists have questioned Walker about why he left college at Marquette with one semester to complete his degree. I think that's a subject that's important. And anyway, I'd just like to hear what the journalists have to say about that question.
All right, Elaine, thanks so much. The John Doe situation in Milwaukee County is definitely a big story. It's getting a lot of attention in like the statewide newspapers, Journal Sentinel and whatnot. Also some AP play. Jerry Gallagher, any thoughts? What about the Marquette situation? I've seen references to that and that there might have been some kind of election stuff going on when he was running for college president or something like that.
Well, as we just talked about with regard to the 47% comment and what Roger Rivard said, if there's something to that, it'll come out.
Yeah.
Somebody knows something that would have an agenda, it'll come out. And in my years in the business, what I found is people in very high positions, it does not take an incredible amount of digging by the journalist for stuff like that to be revealed, because there are those that have an axe to grind, and if it's factual, it will come out and be proven very quickly.
Right.
So if there's something to that, we'll hear more about it.
Don Hoopshire, any thoughts?
Well, I don't really have too much to add to that. Yeah, I think that if it was something sinister, or that he did something that got him kicked out of college, or he, you know, eventually it probably will come out. But I guess the question is, you know, how does that affect his ability to be governor of Wisconsin? You know, you can say, I don't, it shows that he didn't achieve a goal or whatever, but I don't know that it, you know, deems him, disqualifies him from being governor of Wisconsin.
Right. With that, we're going to take our final break. We're going to get back and we'll talk about some other news stories from the region, from the local area, and from the state, nation, what have you, when we return with the news of the West Side 2012 News Year in Review on Wisconsin Public Radio. And welcome back. You're listening to the West Side 2012 News Year in Review. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for tuning us in on Ideas 88.3 WHWC, Menominee Eau Claire. Joining me in the studio are a couple of veteran news reporters that are working here in Eau Claire, and I'm joined by Don Hoopshire, he's the editor of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, and I'm joined by Jerry Gallagher, assistant news director at WQOW News 18. We're talking about the top stories of 2012. We're just taking a look back at the past 365 days have passed in the year. So give us a call. Let us know what you think was a top story or what was your favorite story for whatever reason. The number, 800-228-5615. That number again, 800-228-5615. I've never been strong with math or even simple counting, gentlemen, so I apologize for that. A story that came out recently, a gas price study put together by some students at UW-Eau Claire, I believe. It kind of surprised me when I moved to Eau Claire because there was all this discussion, and, you know, everywhere people are going to be mad about the gas prices, but I was going to say, I've never lived in a community where they asked the state, and then when the state said, no, nothing going on here, then they still wanted more. How long have you been covering, or how long has your paper been covering the angst about gas prices in Eau Claire, Don Hoopshire?
Well, I've been here almost 26 years. almost 26 years.
Yeah.
And I'm sure probably longer than that. And, you know, I was talking to a fellow who stopped by the office today on this very topic. And one of the things is, why can't – it's like, well, there's nothing going wrong. Okay, then why can't we be lower once in a while? And I think that's what's frustrating, is that anybody comes back from a trip, the first thing they tell you is how much cheaper gas is every place else, and it's consistent. Mm-hmm. And it's just a point of frustration because, you know, gas and healthcare are the two things you have to have in this world, and
right. And
there's not much you can do about it. And if you're forced to drive for your job or for, you know, your business, you have to move product. Over time, it's an added expense that is frustrating because there's other surveys that show the average wage around here isn't the best. And so you put those two together, and it's just a point of continued frustration.
Jerry, the price of gas dropping yesterday or today in parts of western Wisconsin, actually below $3.
Oh.
$2.99, I think, in Baldwin.
Really?
Yep. And we haven't seen that a year.
I'm on my way.
At the same time, Quick Trip raised its gas prices by a nickel today in Eau Claire to $3.29. Mm. And people just are screaming for more competition. That's what they want. You know, they want to see these, you know, two, three major retailers kind of go at it a little bit, you know, and fight a little bit harder for our penny.
Well, and that's the thing. That's what this most recent study said. And I'm not sure. I can't remember the details from the Department of Department of Agriculture and Trade and Consumer Protection that did the last one. But they said, yeah, not enough competition. We've got two chains here.
Don wrote an editorial about this today in the Leader Telegram, and one of the things that you pick out of that is it was kind of a new piece about the density. I mean, that was a relatively right. – I had not heard that as an argument, and you addressed that somewhat in your editorial this mm-hmm. morning. I thought that was interesting.
I did not catch it. I apologize. I will read it right after the show. But the density, what do you mean?
What the university study found is that the stations are spaced far enough apart, for the most part, that there's no incentive. In other words, you pull up to an intersection, and here's a gas station over here. Here's a gas station across the street. You know, if one's charging 2 cents less, like the fellow over at Claremont and Menominee, you know, if one of the chains were across the street from him, it would be interesting to see what they would charge.
Hmm.
But, you know, and I don't know how important that is. I mean, there's a Quick Trip and a Mega Holiday on Gulf Road across the street from each other. It doesn't seem to make any difference. But if you had more players and, you know, more density, maybe it would.
Just twice in the last year, and I've been here now 11 years, and I'd never seen this before because I try to follow it as much as I can. Twice in the last year on Gulf Road, you have Quick Trip and you have Mega Holiday across the street. And Quick Trip twice raised its prices by a nickel, once this summer, once this fall. And over the course of 24 to 36 hours, Mega never moved. And so eventually Quick Trip lowered, went back to its original price. And that was unusual. It was unusual to the point that we reported it because it was something that we just had not seen. And I think that that's kind of what people are clamoring more for that to happen.
I will say, though, that even in Superior, you know, that's where I'm from originally, we saw the same thing. I mean, gas prices were always higher than they were in Minnesota. That is because of tax stuff. But the prices were all the same all across the entire city. And there people were complaining because we have the state's only oil refinery in Superior, and they said, well, why, we've got a refinery there, why is it more expensive? But
I think what stings more is when you leave the state.
Yeah.
You know, when you go somewhere like Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, and you see prices are 25 to 30 cents cheaper, and minimum markup law might have something to do with that, and that's something lawmakers could very well take a look at.
All right. We're going to be we're wrapping up to the top of the hour here. How about we talk about the Confluence Project? We've had a program recently about that, waiting on a report to come out, I believe, that'll kind of explain where we go from here. Don Hoopshire, a lot of steam behind the project so far. Still have a couple, or at least one group that isn't too happy about it, the Historical Foundation. But
Well, if you were going to ask me what's my favorite story of the year, that would be it.
How so?
Well, just that I've lived here, like I said, almost 26 years, and just kind of a stagnant downtown, and you know we look north of the river, the Eau Claire River, when the RCU project happened, and we can see what that was a catalyst for.
Yeah.
You know, tremendous change, tremendous improvement, vibrant, you know, just a place to be. And now there's a chance to do something south of the Eau Claire River on South Barstow Street. And, you know, there's no guarantees. And, you know, will the numbers work? Will the money work? You know, can this thing be supported? You know, is it going to be a year-to-year drain? You know, those are things that have to be watched. But I think it has the potential to really change our downtown for the better. And I really hope it works. I mean, that it can work. You know, but again, you just don't want to go running headlong into something that doesn't make sense. But I think it's a chance to build a new history for our city.
All right, Jerry Gallagher, any thoughts? And if not on the Confluence Project?
Well, the Board of Regents has a big decision to make next year in terms of funding, and so we'll see where that goes. But I've also spoke to – we hear a lot of people say the exact same thing that Don said, and also those that say, well, if you were going to go this far, why not go even bigger? You know, and build that convention center that many people have been calling for that would draw in some of those bigger acts. And then there are those that say, well, you're never going to get those. It'll sit empty. It's something that's been debated for many years in this community.
All right. We got a quick favorite story from Don. What's your favorite story of 2012?
You know, it might have been Scotty Meyer. You know, I just love those stories that, you know, the despair, from despair comes hope and renewal of hope, and that this little boy with autism that disappeared during the week of the 4th of July, and he was missing for over 24 hours, and he was found safe, and he was found by somebody, a perfect stranger, who had come out to help in the rescue search. I mean, I just That's that cool. That was such an uplifting story, I think.
And for my part, favorite story of 2012, Nessie.
Oh, yeah.
The statue that was placed in the river, DNR said take it out. It made national news. I mean, how often is that going to happen? Plus, the folks that made it over there at the stone place, I can't think of it, but good people. So that does it, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you, guests. Don Hoopsher, Jerry Gallagher, you guys did great, and we'll have you back, I'm sure, next year, if all goes well tomorrow. But for everyone else, have a happy holidays. We'll be off the air next week, but we will be back in January. I'm Rich Kramer. This is The West Side.